Hello, and welcome again to Jim Brown's Outrigged Capercast of Modern Nautical Lore. Let's see, where are we now in the historical sequence of early seafaring multi-hulls? Where are we?
Well, you told us more than we ever thought possible about the origin of modern catamarans. Unless you're going to give us a final exam, I suppose you should go right into trimarans and hope to explain the differences. So let's say this is Capercast number 3. And well, Tiger? Where in time do you want to start pontificating?
Come on, Christy. Gee, anybody who doesn't want to listen to this stuff can turn it off. After all, I guess I'm one of the only old shellbacks left still standing who can talk about the early days of modern multihulls. So let me tell you about Arthur Piver. Yeah, Piver with a P rhymes with diver, and he's the guy who popularized the modern trimaran. And I got in on this one. Piver and I got to know each other pretty well there in the late 1960s. We felt like missionaries with a cause. It seemed to us that these boats were so obviously superior they were going to take over the world in about 5 years. Well, it only took about 50. But in the end, it was a pretty sad story, although it sure did start out with a bang. I was fresh in from the Caribbean and had come to California to learn about fiberglass, then a new material. I was living in a houseboat in Sausalito and working at a boat factory and riding my motorcycle, and for a while there was all that I wanted, but I began to feel boatless. Here was this beautiful bay with the strongest sailing winds day in and day out of any yachting center in the world. And I saw a little boat under sail there one day, and the thing was unreasonably rapid. A friend of mine knew the owner. I contacted him, and the next thing I knew, I was out there in the Golden Gate with him, Arthur Piver. We met where he kept his boat there at Belvedere, and up close, I noticed that the boat was really crude. It kind of looked like a collection of plywood boxes painted with a mixture of rather unattractive house paint. The mast was the spar for a TV antenna. The sails were made of mylar film stuck together with scotch tape. They rattled impossibly in the wind. And the workmanship was really rough, but he explained, "Hey, it's just a prototype. I'm experimenting here." He was a San Francisco businessman, you know, showed up in a business suit, a balding, late 40-ish, powerful guy. I would learn that he had a wife and two teenage daughters and a nice home in Mill Valley, California. But on this day, he seemed like just a regular businessman until we got out in the boat. And all of a sudden, he became a big kid. Sailing with him turned out to be enormous fun. In this little 16-footer, we clawed our way out of Raccoon Straits and crossed the bay for the Golden Gate Bridge. And the closer we got, the more I realized that the tide was roaring in, with the wind on top of it also coming in. And we had a real thrash, but he kept us to the north side of the channel, pretty much out of the current. And we beat our way out beyond the bridge for at least a mile. The wind was blowing its usual summer afternoon of 15 knots or so, and the boat would have been overpowered if there had not been two of us to hike. So he just drove the daylights out of the thing until we approached the Potato Patch Shoal. It's an infamous flat on the north side of the channel, very well marked with lighted buoys, the home of many a shipwreck, and he just took us charging into these conditions that... Well, the waves resembled little Matterhorns. They would stand up with three sides on them, and the tops would tumble down all three sides at once. It was amazingly rough in there. But we crept along the beach close-hauled until we were in a position to bear off, and the boat accelerated out through the very roughest of the stuff. And I was flabbergasted at the way the thing just went driving through that washboard condition. The waves were as high as the boom. We were going at least 10 knots at times, and the decks were awash. The spray was flying. We were soaked. The footwell was half full, self-bailing footwell, half full half the time. But the little boat just kept smashing through. Back and forth we went across the potato patch shoal. It was water where no one with an ordinary boat would really dare to go. I noticed that Art kept looking out to seaward, and finally he said, "Here comes one." It was a freighter entering the Golden Gate. We waited for it until it came close, and Piper started sailing for it. It looked to me like almost into its path. But half of the ship had gone by the time we got very close, and he started singing a local nonsense ballad of the day, something about, "Feed up, pat him on the popo, let's hear him laugh, ha." It was about some guy playing with his kid, you know. And he was singing this thing, and then he said, "Here comes a pat on the popo now." And it turned out to be the stern wave of the freighter. And just as it overtook the boat, he left the helm, actually dropped it, and threw himself against the mast. And the boat caught the wave, and off we went at the same speed as the freighter, probably about 15 knots, playing this stern wave. It was continuous surfing for the next 2 miles, headed back into the Golden Gate. And he played that wave like an expert. I later learned that he, too, like Woody, had been an avid surfer in his youth. We were almost underneath the fantail of the ship, and some guy came to the stern rail. It must have been the cook. He had on a chef's hat, you know, and a big tub of, I don't know, potato peelings, which he dumped over the side, and then saw us and gasped, disappeared immediately, came back quickly with 3 or 4 other guys, and they were all leaning over the rail with their mouths open, watching us surf this wave as we passed underneath the Golden Gate. Now, that ride was even more formative for me than that amazing dash I had had with Woody Brown off of Diamond Head. Piper's little boat did everything you told it to. You know, it would come about reliably, and went to windward like a demon, and you could certainly steer it downwind on big waves. Whereas Woody's boat had so much raw speed with so little control. As we were on the way back from that dash off of Diamond Head, I realized that she was very slow in stays, mushy, coming out of the tacks, even required backing the helm sometimes and backing the jib. And off the wind that day, they were unable to control her, to bring her up, and so they had to actually dump the sheets in order to stop her headlong dash. Now, it would be years before I fully understood that there were reasons for that. Woody was trying to operate from the beaches. No daggerboard, no centerboard, no spade rudder. Whereas Piper's boat had all of those things. A real deep, high aspect ratio daggerboard and a wonderful spade rudder. And she also had other features that contributed to her maneuverability, which I'll try to describe when I undertake to follow Christie's instructions to draw the distinctions between catamarans and trimarans. So I immediately began building a little frolic trimaran for myself. I was kind of a handy guy, knew how to work with my hands, but I was certainly not a boat builder. And after a couple of weeks of fooling around, I was so disappointed with the results that I sold them to some unsuspecting friends and started over. And after a couple of months of every minute of my spare time and a couple of $100, I had myself a little frolic trimaran, and man, was it a blast. And with this initiation, I was enrolled in a budding group of Piver's disciples. There was his old bosom friend Fred Jukic, who had built a similar boat. There was the Viking-like Rich Girling, who would eventually make many distance passages with Piver in larger boats, and a young high school guy named Lauren Williams, who was taking a course in mechanical drawing and ended up being Piver's draftsman for some years. Piver said of his own mechanical drawing, it looked like some drunk had produced the drawings. But at about this time, late 1957, I guess, the company that I was working for began to bounce our paychecks, and so I took to building houses up in Squaw Valley in the High Sierras. The Winter Olympics were to be held there in 1960, so there was a building boom going on. So with the help of a good friend, Peter Clausen, I worked through the winter up there, commonly worked in 3 feet of snow, and I began to dream of going back to the Caribbean. And I had the outrageous idea that I could get there in a great big Frolic trimaran. Now, Frolic was 16 feet long, 2 sheets of 8-foot long plywood. I thought by adding another sheet, a 24-foot vessel would be huge by comparison and adequate for making a coastal voyage down the western seaboard to Panama and up into the Caribbean. So I went back down to San Francisco to present this idea to Arthur Piver. And behold, it turned out that he had already designed a 24-foot trimaran. He called it Nugget. It was intended as a 4-place open day sailor. Frolic was a 2-place open day sailor. And one had already been built by a guy named Carlton Eugene, an auto upholstery man over in San Francisco. Piver put me in touch with Carlton, and Carlton took me for a ride, and we went out again into the potato patch. So I was able to sell my share in one of the houses we were building up in Squaw Valley, and I immediately began to build my own Nugget trimaran. Now, the notion of going to sea in the thing was a bit off the wall for both me and Piver, but we had things to talk about other than trimarans. Yes, indeed, we had both spent time in big schooners. His family had owned the Elegant Eloise, and that's how Piver got to Hawaii and learned to ride surf. So we both had some sea time under us, and when I approached him with the notion of taking off for the Caribbean, he thought about it for quite a while. I wanted to put a little cuddy cabin on the boat and make it as seaworthy as possible, but I also said, hey, you know, a coastal voyage. If I really get in trouble, I can always head for the beach. And after a while, he said, well, Jim, you know, you're the first experienced sailor to become interested in my designs, and you know what you're doing, so I guess you could sail a boat like that anywhere. And, of course, I like to think that the modern seafaring trimaran marks its own conception at that moment. Well, by early 1959, I had my boat about 3/4 built, and had another piece of great good fortune. I bumped into a girl. Joanna and I met at a party on a Sausalito houseboat, and it didn't take us long. A couple months later, we decided we were to take the whole trip together, and here we are 57 years later, still sailing along. But back then, it was midsummer before I had the boat built, and of course, by then, she was like 5 months pregnant with our firstborn, Stephen. And so now we had a chance to make some really dumb decisions. The only smart thing we did was to get married at the courthouse, but we really wanted to go on this trip together. We knew we should wait until at least December in order to hit fair weather on the western seaboard. But if we had waited that long, the baby would be among us, and the boat was too small to support an infant. So we figured that, what the heck, we would go. We would go. Joanna spoke with her gynecologist, said that she was going to go on an ocean cruise. And the doctor said, will there be a doctor on board? And Joanna simply declined to go back to the gynecologist. Of course, he thought we were going to be on a cruise liner. But we got the boat in the water, went through some trials, had a good time except for breaking the mast once. I repaired that in a few days, changed the rigging plan a bit, and figured that with Joanna in her condition, we would need a third member in the crew. I mean, she was a school teacher from Kansas, for Pete's sake. She'd never been to sea. And, you know, the whole thing got to be quite unreasonable there for a while. Our friends were giving us the business for taking this on. But we were determined to go, and a friend named Dick York was determined to go with us. Joanna said she could have the baby anywhere so long as we stopped in time, and I agreed to stop in time anywhere. We were all so smitten with adventure lust. Between the three of us, Joanna, Dick, and I, we had maybe $2,000. So we sold or gave away everything we had, and without ever intending to return to California, we said a fond goodbye to all of our friends, sailed out the Golden Gate, and turned left.
Hold it, Jimmy. You've got to leave us in suspense right there. No time here to tell about that caper. It was the first real seafaring for a modern trimaran, wasn't it? You say you didn't know it then, or you wouldn't have cared, but if I know anything about your tender ego, I bet you are rather proud of that caper. So get the story straight and dump it on us next time. Okay? For now, I'm not even going to let you say fair winds.
What a pushy martinet. Anyway, that's the nicest thing one sailor can say to another.